Crowley can't get away from Pendergrass in any way. Not even contract negotiations that the boy's not part of. It's like, well, we can't give you what you want because we haven't given it to the other lad.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Hey there, it's Owen here and you're welcome back to Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off The Ball. In every episode of this series, we go to a different country in Latin America. And this week, we are going to Mexico. We're going to be hanging out with Lucha Libre fighters and hearing about the social impact of sport in the country's poorest state. And we are going on a magic mushroom journey. That's coming your way in just a few minutes. Before that though, if you're a first-time listener, just to let you know, we begin every episode with an update on my hitchhiking journey through Patagonia. The previous four installments on this journey are at the beginning of the previous four episodes, if you're keen to listen back to them. So, Mexico is coming your way in just a couple of minutes, after we bring you up to speed on the hitchhiking. There's going to be some bad language in this episode, and as ever, your 5-star ratings, your likes, your shares, they all make a massive difference, so we'd appreciate any of that if you enjoy this episode. Cheers.
Okay, so this has quickly gone from a very, very good day to a very, very shit day.
I've made a terrible decision. I got too curious about what lies on the other side of Patagonia, and so I've decided to try pull off a 600-kilometre hitchhike in a single day, going from west to east.
With every passing hour, the possibility of getting to a big city or a big town becomes less.
I am now stranded in a place called Paso de Indios. I've got my eye on the petrol station now, because when the sun sets in a couple of hours, an indoor bench might have to be my bed for the evening. And if the petrol station isn't open 24 hours, well, there's also this massive turquoise barn adjacent to it. If that sort of thing was good enough for the birth of Jesus Christ himself, it'll be good enough for me. Some gauchos have arrived. There appears to be some kind of festival here today. Festival might be overstating it a touch, though. What we have are some men and some boys in their gaucho clothes and gaucho berets riding their horses into town, and they're parading down a road and back up to Route 25 again. There are no more than a dozen of them, trotting up and down, with one or two women standing on the footpath watching. The police have sent one single officer to seal off the road from any traffic that may interrupt these festivities. He need not worry. I wander over for a chat with the policeman.
¿Qué es tu nombre? Martín Paul. Mucho gusto, amigo.
And if the wind wasn't so bad in this clip,
¿qué es la razón para la fiesta?
You would hear him tell me that there is a big dance happening in the Turquoise Barn tonight. Maybe this is a sign. Maybe I go to that dance, meet the love of my life, and settle down here in this tiny town where the wind never stops howling. My face becomes weather-beaten beyond recognition, and my children become gauchos. But with all due respect to the singletons of Paso de Indios, I would rather get out of here. Unfortunately, hitching a lift on a horse is probably not going to take me the 344 kilometres I still need to travel before I get to Trelew. But most of the cars that go by are not going that far. The ones that are going that far are very evidently big spending rent-a-car tourists from abroad who will never pick up a hitchhiker, I've come to realise. So a trucker is my only hope. But Route 25 isn't exactly a bustling trade route. There is a man transporting oil through Argentina right now. His name is Walter. The oil he is bringing to Trelew is coming from Buenos Aires, his hometown. So why on earth he is driving west to east is unclear. But all that matters is that he is. He drives past Esquel down Route 40. He comes to the T-junction at Teca and turns left to continue down Route 25. He keeps going and arrives at Paso de Indios. In the distance, as the road climbs a hill, Walter sees a man standing on the side of the road. He is a ginger man, not very Argentinian looking, but very alone looking and quite worried looking. He's got a big backpack on and he's being abused by the gale force winds. Walter feels sympathy. Walter stops his truck. The ginger stranger is an Irish man, and despite being terrible at Spanish, Walter can understand how elated he is. It seems to be like the greatest moment of this guy's life. Yes, Walter is today's Lord and Saviour.
So, ¿dónde son? ¿Alemania dónde son?
No, Irlanda.
He's going to take me all the way to Trelew. And not only that, he's getting me fed and watered. He's giving me a couple of empanadas. He's got this massive gas canister in his cabin to boil water fresh and provide some coffee.
Ahora es lo más lindo. Sí. Lo más bello, vas a ver.
Sí. Sí. Yeah, okay, muy bien.
And the landscape becomes a little less barren. He stops his truck, tells me to get out. He takes photos of me beside a hill or a river or something. He's my boyfriend of Instagram right now, it seems. It's hard to tell exactly what the attraction is here and what he's taking a photo of, because in the photo, his truck takes up most of the screen. And I'm okay with that, because, yeah, it is beautiful here, with the Chubut River now running alongside us, and I've got some actual green vegetation in sight for the first time in days. But this truck really is the star of the show. It's my lifeboat. We drive for hours, and I watch just another outrageous desert sunset in the wing mirror. And I know we're getting close to civilization again because a radio signal appears. Football. There's a Friday night fixture being broadcast live on the radio. Puerto Madryn, one of the bigger cities here in the Chubut province, are the away team.
Ah, con Brown juega, que es de Córdoba.
Ah, Córdoba.
Almirante Brown.
They're away to Racing de Córdoba, and Racing de Córdoba eventually win the game 3-1. It's second division football.
No, it's Primera División, no?
No.
Segunda?
Sí.
Not a single team in Patagonia plays in the top tier. Route 25 is almost done. Small towns begin to appear.
Okay.
The first big sign features a hulking red dragon, accompanied by the text, Crocho ir Gaiman. Welcome to Gaiman. My apologies to all Welsh speakers for my attempt at that pronunciation. There are a handful of towns in this region with a real Welsh imprint, and Gaiman is arguably the most Welsh of the lot. It has tea houses and rugby, and lots of red dragon emblems all across the town. In a future episode of this podcast, I will bring you inside Gaiman, and we go a bit deeper into the little Wales that it is. But tonight, I'm going all the way to Trelew, a much bigger city. A better chance of getting a bed. I say my goodbyes to Walter, and thank him profusely for saving me. It is Friday night, and I stumble upon an establishment called 24/7 Bar. But 24/7 Bar is closed. So I find myself a cheap hostel bed. I thank my lucky stars that I'm not stuck in a barn on Route 25. And I sleep. For a long time. Six months earlier. It is my first ever week in Latin America. I've travelled from the United States to Mexico, and when I cross the land border, strangely everything around me does not turn to sepia. It's Mexican Independence Day. This is the Zócalo of Mexico City, the main square of the city today, and also the central point of the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan. Mexico's president is standing on a balcony overlooking us, and he's shouting,
¡Viva México!
¡Viva!
¡Viva México!
¡Viva!
¡Viva México!
¡Viva!
He's reenacting a call from the year 1810, when the priest Miguel Hidalgo addressed the town of Dolores and triggered the Mexican War of Independence. It is a cry that is replicated every year and kickstarts a long night, a rollover, and a long second night. I don't really have a plan for what I'm going to do in Mexico. And I don't have a plan for what these next few months will look like, if I'm honest. I do know that I really want to get to Argentina by the time the 2022 World Cup is happening, but I've no real clue of where I want to stop on the way. I do have some ideas, but the problem is that I've got no contacts whatsoever, and I've yet to even get myself to a bad level of Spanish speaking. One area of Mexican culture that I'm keen to explore is that of Lucha Libre.
¿Qué va a ser de la comarca?
If you've never heard that phrase before, it's basically the lads in the masks wrestling. In Mexico City, there is Arena Mexico. It's got a capacity of 16,500 and attracts visitors from all over the world to come see the luchadores and luchadoras in action. Going to these events, though, is not really of interest to me. The ambition is to meet some of the wrestlers on the lower rungs of the game and see what an independent promotion looks like. The challenge, though, is finding someone to open that door for me. I find that whenever you're having any bit of trouble in a different country, there's never any harm in pulling out the Irish card. And would you believe it? There is an Irish luchador. Sorry, let me rephrase that actually. Of course there is an Irish luchador.
El nombre del segundo gladiador es Dana Burns, que hoy fue presentado como hooligan. No recuerdo.
Irish hooligan.
Dana Burns.
Yes.
His name is Darren Burns, aka the Irish hooligan, and he is from County Waterford.
How you feel today and with a victory?
You might have wanted to take up the subtitles on the screen. You see, I might have been the weakest link here tonight. I might have got un, dos, tres. But why? Because I followed the rules of Lucha Libre. I was the weakest link tonight. But the next time you see me, I'm breaking all the rules because I am the Irish hooligan.
Sadly, the Irish hooligan is now living back home in Ireland. I message him on Instagram then to see if he can set me up with anyone. Anyone who might have a bit of English. His reply? I know just the guy.
Okay, we are here in Mexico City. We're about to go see some Lucha Libre tonight. It is a Sunday evening.
I've been sent the address of an apartment in the Lagunilla district of Mexico City. The person that opens the door when I show up is a hulking mountain of a man.
I'm actually in the home right now of one of the wrestlers.
He has his hair tied up in a bun and is wearing jeans and a black t-shirt and a chain. He kind of looks like that meme of a young version of The Rock, the one where he's leaning on the staircase with the turtleneck. This particular wrestler, though, is called Herodes Jr.
I'm a professional wrestler from 15 years. I'm training jiu-jitsu, CrossFit, training wrestling in the gym. All time, living Lucha Libre all time, bro.
He brings with him a small suitcase with wheels, like one you'd bring onto a cabin of an airplane. It holds all of his clothes for his costume, and apparently also quite a lot of oil.
Cinnamon oil is traditional for the Mexican wrestlers. All time put oil in the skin.
Are you a good guy or a bad guy?
Oh, my face is for the bad guy all time. No, can't change. But in the history of wrestling, Mexican wrestling is rudos and técnicos, right? But for tradition, my father, before time, is big Rudo in Lucha Libre, right? I'm same.
Herodas' father carved out a pretty impressive career in the wrestling game. He fought with people such as Chavo Guerrero, and I know nothing about Lucha Libre, so when I hear that someone was a teammate of a name that I actually recognize like Chavo Guerrero, I know it's probably a pretty big deal. Herodas Sr. passed away in 2020, so Herodas Jr. here fights for his memory. He's a bad guy in the ring, because it's what his dad would have wanted. In the ring, it's what his dad was. Myself and Herodas Jr. are joined by one of his friends.
My name is Lou. Lourdes, realmente, but you can say just Lou.
Lou has already come dressed as a wrestler, even though she's not fighting. The three of us hop in an Uber and we begin to drive. We drive through the dodgy neighborhood of Tepito. We drive through these lattices of concrete intersections on the outskirts of the city. And we go up the mountains. The climate changes a little bit, and a beautiful sunny Sunday afternoon is now a washout. We are no longer in Mexico City. We are in a place called Naucalpan de Juarez.
So we are pretty far from main area.
You were in an Uber for a long time.
Yes. So this is a kind of far, far, far away place, a kind of dangerous place, but it's a pretty interesting place to have a first lucha show.
You've taken me to a dangerous part of Mexico.
More or less, yeah, to be honest, yes. It's not the reason you are with us all the time.
You're looking after me well.
No.
Yeah, really hoping she just didn't understand my turn of phrase there.
How do you know Herodas?
Well, I know Herodas because I used to go in the gym. He is bringing classes. So I became his student.
His prodigy.
Exactly. Yeah. He's my professor and now he's actually my friend too. So it's how I know him.
You've seen him wrestle before, right?
Yeah.
So how good is he?
Well, I think honestly that he's one of the best wrestlers that I know it. Because he can make a lot of styles. Yeah. You will see. Don't be impatient. Yeah, you will see. He's pretty cool. And as a wrestler, I told you, I the most thing that I appreciate, I think is his passion. His passion for this sport, because it's a pretty dangerous, interesting, funny but sport, but over everything, it's dangerous. One of the most beautiful things is when people came around and they really love luchadors, you know. For Mexicans, when they say, like, oh, I'm a luchador, everybody wanna be your friend. And so that part is super cool.
Yeah, she's not wrong. Everyone does kind of want to be your friend. I might have been brought to what is allegedly a dangerous part of the country for a gringo, but I'm a gringo who Herodas Jr. has brought along with him. And there's a sense of safety in that. The staff on the door are all smiles and peace signs when we walk in. And you enter from the road and walk down a ramp into what is a big hall with an iron roof on it. They've got balloons and fairy lights and Mexico flags everywhere. It's low on budget, but high on colour. Between fights, the local kids run into the ring to copy some of the moves they've just watched the wrestlers perform. These fighters are very clearly their heroes. There's a stage hidden behind a curtain where the fighters get ready. I visit Herodas backstage, and he lets me in on one condition, that I don't take any videos or photos of fighters without their masks on.
How are you feeling?
A little nervous. This match is very important with me. The opponent this night is very hard in the style, hardcore match. I'm feeling good, but my partner, George, is a good partner and helped me for this night match.
Herodas' partner is Jorge Cabrada.
I'm 100% Mexican. I was born here. I started in Brooklyn, New York when I was 15. I'm 31 now, so I've been wrestling for 16 years. I've been living in Mexico City for about 10 years, just trying things out. You know, I've been able to wrestle for some really good companies. And this is pretty much my life, so that's why I'm down here in Mexico City. They've brought me in with Herodas, a tag team, just to be heels. That's our job, you know. My job is to be a heel, a rough guy out there, bring a lot of heat, bring a lot of moves, a lot of action, power, and pretty much just demolish. That's my job. That's what I'm here to do. I'm a bad guy. I don't like applauses. I don't like signing autographs. You're very lucky that I'm giving you an interview because I'm a very rough guy. I tend to be more just go out there, do my job.
Watching the evening unfold from this vantage point behind the curtain is kind of fascinating, because you see the genuine nerves up close. You watch some fighters pace up and down in front of us. Some of them kneel and pray. Some of them merely practice the choreography of the fight that's been scripted. And some of them just drink a beer or have a cigarette. When their name is called, they disappear behind the curtain to a cacophony of boos or loud adulation. The crowd noise will soon tell you if the good guy or the bad guy has won. When their bout is over, the fighters then re-emerge on our side of the curtain. Some of them are on cloud nine, while some are pretty battered and bloodied. There's one man in particular who re-emerges quite broken. I've watched him through the curtain get his arse handed to him. Of course, this was how the fight was scripted, but the cuts on his face and the blood in his mouth reminds you of the authenticity that remains even within these parameters. He poses for one photo after the fight before he comes back beyond the curtain. The person he's posing with is very clearly his daughter, and she's bawling her eyes out. So to all intents and purposes, this girl has just watched her dad take a very, very bad and very real beating here. It's almost time for the main event, which is Herodes and Jorge's fight.
You want to kick ass tonight?
Yeah, old night kick ass for this moment for me is very important, yeah. Kick ass and broken noses and broken ribs, yeah, all time.
Hide your moms!
Hey, hide your moms.
Indeed, hide your moms. Now, I don't know who needs to hear this, but the bad guys in Lucha Libre, or any sort of wrestling for that matter, generally aren't actually bad guys. Herodes Jr. and Jorge are, in fact, very friendly and pleasant individuals. But now they have laced up their big boots, Jorge has put on his bandana and his leotard, Herodes Jr. has let his hair down, the tights are on, but the top is off, and all of their remaining clothing is black. They now resemble the bad guys, or the heels, or around here, the rudos. Pardon the bad language here, but together, Jorge and Herodes are known as the motherfuckers.
Hey, hey, hey! People, listen to motherfuckers!
You're looking at two of the best professional wrestlers in Mexico City! We are the motherfuckers, and tonight, we have a interesting night. We're heels, we're the best of the best, and we're here to kick ass. Is that simple? You like it or you don't like it? And we got two more things to tell you. You better hide your mom, you better hide your wife, and you better even hide your sister, because the motherfuckers are coming for you, baby.
They emerge from behind the curtain. Children eagerly wait for them and put out their hands, hoping for a high five. But these children are obviously ignored, like pieces of dirt on the shoes of these two bad boys. Before things get underway, Jorge takes the microphone off the MC. And what he does next astonishes me, because we're in deepest, darkest Mexico, and Jorge makes the decision to start chatting shit in English. There are like two people in this room who know what Jorge is saying, and I am one of them. I have now officially lost count of the number of mothers that Jorge has claimed he will engage in sexual intercourse with. There's something about his tone of voice that tells the crowd that he is not saying nice things, because an elderly woman beside him gives him the middle finger. One of his opponents is a big man wearing a Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls jersey. and he's heard enough shy talk for one Sunday. He takes the microphone off Jorge, and the groups of fighters finally begin to beat the crap out of one another. And I must say, it is a very enjoyable spectacle. I watch Herodes choke the referee. I watch him whack the Michael Jordan guy with a chair. And he and Jorge enjoy some early dominance. However, my keen wrestling instinct tells me that there might be some sort of twist coming. And sure enough, a man about half the size of both Jorge and Herodes manages to somehow flip them both out of the ring at one time. It is remarkable strength and athleticism. Herodes then gets headbutted. He gets his face smashed off the metal pole at the corner of the ring. And he then realizes the reality of karma when Michael Jordan jersey guy eventually whacks him with the same chair. Herodes then takes a brush to the back, and the brush breaks in half upon contact. Jorge, meanwhile, is getting body slammed by Michael Jordan jersey guy. It then becomes apparent that actually there are three people on each team. There's some other guy on Jorge and Herodes' team. I realise this because while the two lads are outside the ring trying to pick themselves off the ground, this other teammate gets pinned in the ring. And the motherfuckers have been defeated. To be fair, they're quite quick to throw this mystery third teammate under the bus.
The important thing here is, I didn't lose, he didn't lose. Maybe if we would have been in the ring, we would have won. It's unfortunate we lost today, but it doesn't really matter. We're still gonna go fuck their mother.
How does your body feel now?
Oh, pain in my back. All time living with pain. It's normal in wrestling life. My back all time say, hey, take it easy, but I like the pain. I'm addict to the pain. I like the hardcore, the scars in my head. My fingers broken, my ribs, my nose, my teeth all time. No problem, I can do it next match tomorrow.
And maybe he does fight tomorrow. He'll certainly be training in his gym tomorrow, teaching the next generation of young luchadors how to make it in this game. Herodes Jr. has a dream to fight in Japan and the United States, and to take these anti-hero qualities all around the world. Most of the audiences he fights in front of will want him to be beaten. So Herodes is carving out a path to the top, accepting that he needs to get beaten up on his way up. I leave Mexico City a couple of days later and head south for the next big celebration on the country's calendar. Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. A multi-day celebration of those who departed too soon and of those who maybe hung around just a little too long. There are altars set up around the streets of towns with photos of the dead front and centre. There are fancy dress competitions for humans and for dogs. It's Halloween on steroids. I'm in San Cristobal de las Casas, and the schedule is demanding. Daytime means going to the outskirts of town to a large graveyard and drinking there for a couple of hours. Evening time means watching the parades go through the centre of the city. And the nighttime involves a trip out to the jungle to track down a rave that I've heard rumours about. A series of wooden platforms up to a shack on the top of a hill, all face a small stage that looks quite like a spaceship, and a heap of local people two-stepping to psytrance for hours. The rumours have proven to be true. San Cristobal de las Casas is my favourite place in Mexico, and that is an opinion I held even before finding that rave. It's not really my place as an outsider to decide what is authentically Mexico and what isn't, but I would guess it is more a matter of fact that San Cristobal is real Mexico. This is the third biggest city in the southern state of Chiapas, near the Guatemala border. Chiapas is a state with a strong indigenous identity. It also happens to be the poorest state in Mexico. San Cristobal is absolutely gorgeous. The art that hangs in the walls of every single shop or bar or cafe is one of the things that will grab you. There's a face that appears repeatedly in this art across the city and across the south of Mexico in general. It's the face of Subcomandante Marcus.
Bueno, finalmente la historia para todos los pueblos y para todas las gentes es su raíz, es lo que te da fundamento.
It's always this image of these serious dark eyes peeking through a black balaclava. He's often holding a cigar in his mouth, sometimes wearing headphones. And he wears a cap with a red star on the front. Subcomandante Marcus is the leader of an army known as the EZLN, initials which in English translate to the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. He is the striking face of the Zapatista movement, in much the same way that Che Guevara is the face of the Cuban Revolution. The Zapatista movement rose to prominence in the late 1980s and into the 90s as a result of the Mexican government going big on neoliberalism. The poor, working and agricultural class around here didn't really stand a chance when foreign investment was waved into Mexico. Indigenous farmland was bought up by wealthy international and Mexican companies, and around 50,000 people were forced out of their homes and into the jungle. The policy of the Mexican government resulted in the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. NAFTA, of course, was great for big Mexican business, but terrible for the non-rich people in Chiapas. So, New Year's Day, 1994. The day NAFTA came into effect. The Zapatistas rose up. They occupied San Cristobal and other towns nearby, and they declared war on the Mexican state. From a balcony on the main square in San Cristobal, they read their proclamation.
Por lo tanto, y conforme a esta declaración de guerra, damos a nuestras fuerzas militares del Ejército Zapatista Liberación Nacional las siguientes órdenes.
The fighting between the Zapatistas and the Mexican state technically goes on for 12 days until a ceasefire is called. And while, since then, there have been treaties signed and promises made, there's still an argument that the Mexican government continues to screw the people of Chiapas over 30 years later. And there's one organization you can point to back up this theory. Can't beat it, can't beat it. The feeling you get from a Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola built a bottling plant in San Cristobal in the 1990s. And to this day, it has a permit to extract over 1 million litres of the local water supply per day. Their bill for this is pretty small, and whatever money they are paying is going to the federal government in Mexico City. It's certainly not going back to Chiapas. This is problematic on a multitude of levels, not least because water is now a valuable commodity around here. It's just as cheap to buy a bottle of Coca-Cola as it is to buy a bottle of drinking water. Plenty of households across the city struggle to go back-to-back days with running water. And for the buildings that do have daily water, the quality is terrible. The daily consumption of Coca-Cola in Chiapas is a whopping 2 litres on average per person. And the drink even now has a place in ritualistic ceremonies and seen by some as a sort of healing liquid. But type 2 diabetes is one of the biggest killers in the region. How an American drinks company has managed to get such a stranglehold on this part of Mexico is anyone's guess. On a totally unrelated note, In the early 2000s, the president of Mexico was Vicente Fox, who was a former head of Coca-Cola Mexico. The outskirts of San Cristobal are a little different to the city centre. Tourists don't venture out on their own too much, and as a result, there's little investment into the upkeep of these areas. I've gone to meet some people in a small playground outside the town. It's a small wooded area with rusty slides and broken swings.
Owen. You don't need to use my name, it's all good. Yeah. You can get away without it.
This small plot of land is in danger of being repossessed and built upon. But a local group of activists want to make it a gym, and they want to make a sports area out of the land. In an area with antisocial problems, they want to use sport to promote a healthier and safer community. This is Nicola, originally from Italy, but now working on social projects in Mexico.
Thanks a lot, Owen. Thanks for visiting us. I arrived here 3 years ago, just traveling. And yeah, so it was just chance. I decided to stay a little bit longer, a few months longer. And yeah, I've been here for 3 years now.
What happened in those few weeks that changed your mind?
Well, life got in the middle. So I participated in a project. I volunteered for a group working on reconstruction of houses in the coast, on the coast of Chiapas. I'm an engineer and I've been working all my life with, topics related to environment. So this war specifical work was on reconstruction of houses that were affected by earthquakes. That is not what I was used to do, but I loved the work, so I stayed. And then I got really into social work, I decided to leave my previous job that was more related to new technology and stuff like that. I decided that I wanted to dedicate more to helping communities here in Chiapas to develop or to get back on their feet from disasters, or helping communities like this neighborhood where you have very big social problems. Mm. I decided just to dedicate more to this kind of stuff than making money or
sure.
Or developing new technologies. That was the idea.
Can you explain to me a little bit about the social problems that you encountered here?
Yeah, well, Mexico is in a war, I would say, even though medias don't talk about it. But since 2006, we have had like 300,000 killed, and something like 100,000 feminicidios. I'm not sure how to say in English,
Femicide problem. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a war that is being held by narco groups and corrupted governments. So in general, you have a really, really unstable situation politically. Specifically in areas like Cuxitali, you have the influence of these criminal groups and they break the society. So you have problems in Chiapas, especially you have problems related to low income, terrible sanitary situation. You have people work for the tourism, and they are really in really bad conditions, like in all these these topics. Mm.
Can you explain to me the sanitary issue? What is the genesis of that?
Well, San Cristobal lives in a really, really terrible sanitary situation because of the bad use is made of water, and because of the use big companies, multinational companies make of the water.
Coca-Cola.
So, yeah, especially Coca-Cola. And people don't have access to medical services normally. The public service is really bad. They are not visited and attended like they should. So the medical issues and sanitary issues are very big here. Kids don't have opportunities. They don't have access to sport because normally sports it's for the middle high class. Gyms are very expensive, and actually the kids from the neighborhood don't even get close to those places. So instead of doing sport and getting attended on their, say, medical health, their health, they just start drinking, and they get in contact with criminal groups, and that's how they, let's say, spend their childhood. And especially when they get around 13, 14, 15, okay, you already see they prefer to stay in the square, drink, and spend time with criminal groups. Obviously, this is not the case for every kid, but there is a big problem related to health and to the influence of these criminal groups, okay, around here.
I also speak to Emilio, who moved here from Mexico City.
As a Mexican, I am somehow close to how the indigenous population treat the place where they live. But however, the situation here in Chiapas is totally different from the center of the country. I mean, here in Chiapas, indigenous population is like really proud of their culture, their practices, and they have like this historical fight, no? Mm. And it's like really, it's totally live and happening right now. And yes, of course, I approach here like in this attitude of respect, first of all, and willing to learn also, because when you arrive here, you know nothing about this environment, and it's always like a process of keeping learning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, just not to get bogged down in history too much, but do you feel that there is still the sort of effects of the 1990s and the Zapatista movement that exists in your relationship as somebody from Mexico City with the people of Chiapas?
It's a process that is happening still now.
Sure.
No? I mean, all the Zapatista influence is like really, really deep rooted here. Mm. No? So you can see it like in simple things, like just in graphics, just in some models that are painted in walls. But however, you can see all the organization that has come to life, no? All these movements that historically has been like invisible, and right now it's like it's right in front of our eyes, no?
Yeah.
All this organization process right here in our neighborhood. I mean, all these the decisions are taken like in a assembly. It's like another kind of democracy, no? Another kind of political practices that are like really rooted in the indigenous practices.
Can I ask you then a broad question on the topic of sport? If I was, sure, to ask you about San Cristobal, this area of Chiapas, what would you say the sporting identity of this part of the world is?
The sporting identity, that's a really good question. Well, I think like the sport is part of human nature, no? We will doing it with whatever we had in our hands. So I think here in particular, team sports are like really popular. Mm-hmm. Team sports, football, basketball, it's like another extension of social relations. There's a lot of people that their principal group is like their team, no?
Yeah.
Their team is like a family, and sometimes they are literally a family, no? Yeah. A family of 11 members,
sure,
playing football. So it's really important, even like in the rhythm of the week, like Saturday or Sunday is like that moment of I am nothing else than a soccer player, a basketball,
sure,
player, no? So it's like really important in this for mental health.
Okay.
Like we don't need anything else than this desire of exercising, this desire of sharing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It should be a basic thing that everybody has, but maybe to an extent it's not something that everybody has, and I guess that's why we're here today, and mm-hmm, why you're doing the work that you do, trying to fundraise for facilities in this area. So can you talk us through the importance of that and the facility that you're trying to construct here, and how important it is, especially for the young people in San Cristobal and the area?
Sure. Cuxtitali, this neighborhood, it's in the periphery of the city. So it's really clear that when you travel from the city center to here, you can see how the city changes. No, all the let's say the government support goes to the city center, to really small areas, but here you cannot see the presence of the government aid or anything else. So we do not have facilities to do sports. I mean, it's everything that we have. So we're looking for this. We're looking for a way to give us ourselves some places to practice. And it's really important here because in this park, it's an area where if we are looking to another site, suddenly someone's gonna take it because of the water or because of the price of the land.
Right.
So we need to, however, we want to keep it as it is, as a place to do sports. So we are taking care of it the way we know, practicing here, doing sports here, using it for what it is, for what it should be.
Yeah, the protection of green space is so unbelievably important, and sometimes we don't see the value in it enough because all we see is that can be turned into an apartment block or a hotel or whatever, and people just see the bottom line. But it's the long-term benefit of maintaining a place like this and building a facility on this, which is so unbelievably important for the community. So do you think that the powers that be, the people that run the local government here, understand that value?
No, I think they don't. I think they don't. I think they are speculated with how San Cristobal is turning into a touristic hotspot. So I think that's what they are thinking about. No, there are really few sport projects, or they are really in this capitalist form of you need to give a lot of money, you need to have a lot of clothes, of equipment to do sports, and we are in a completely other logic. But when I arrived here, I recognize that I have this duty of sharing what I know, and it has been a meaningful gift for me, because when you're in a social project where the money is not involved, the social project gives you gifts in different ways, no? So sometimes I see people from the neighborhood doing their first pull-ups, and it's totally meaningful for me.
How does that make you feel?
Oof, I feel like I am doing something of value.
Yeah.
Because some people might think it's only sports, but there's a psychological reason that every time that you challenge something that you thought that you cannot do, something in your brain changes. You start questioning what other things I can do that I have never think about, that I have spent a lot of time feeling that I am not strong, feeling that I cannot do these things, and now that I can do a push-up, what else can I do? No, it's the logical order of thinking. So it's really, really valuable.
Getting buses around Chiapas is an interesting experience. Routes are sometimes a little over-elaborate, as cartel strongholds tend to be avoided. Its neighbouring state to the west is Oaxaca, but it's a long bus journey to the two most visited places in Oaxaca. There is Oaxaca City, inland, and there is Puerto Escondido on the coast. A beautiful new road goes between these cities, and you no longer need to go up the mountains for a white-knuckle ride through the Sierra Madre Sur to travel between them. However, I would urge you to ignore that fact and lean into the motion sickness and go up the mountains to visit a village called San José del Pacífico. Things to do in San José del Pacífico? Magic mushrooms.
One day we were sitting under a tree when I saw several mushrooms within reach.
Those are the words of Maria Sabina Magdalena Garcia, being read in English in a 1978 documentary.
I remember that our grandparents talked about these mushrooms with great respect I call them holy children.
Maria Sabina was a famous Mazatec shaman who took mushrooms every day from the age of 8.
I put the mushrooms in my mouth and began to chew them. Their taste was not good.
She lived in a place called Huautla de Jimenez, a small town in the Sierra Mazateca, north of Oaxaca City.
We felt that the mushrooms talked to us because we heard a voice that came from the other world.
Part of the reason we know a bit about Maria Sabina is because of the writing of R. Gordon Wasson. Wasson visited the region a number of times in the mid-1950s and would produce what was a fairly seminal piece of journalism in May 1957. A 13-page article in Life magazine was published, entitled Seeking the Magic Mushroom. In the piece, Wasson writes that he and his colleague were the first white men in recorded history to eat these divine mushrooms. He describes the trip that he had, which included a sighting of a mythological beast. He was brought into the home of Maria Sabina to experience this.
We went into the Mazatec area, far from the highways. There we found that rotten bagasse, as it's called, bagasso, covered with mushrooms. These mushrooms I didn't know, had never seen. They were the sacred mushrooms. All your senses are rendered acute. We say that you see visions, you see hallucinations, but that doesn't begin to tell the story. The hallucinations are only part of it. You hear sounds, you smell things. The night was thrilling.
Now, there's no getting away from the fact that Wasson reported on something that was truly new to a Western audience in the 1950s. But there are real questions about how he carried out his work. In Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, he writes that by 1955, the Mazatecs used mushrooms not for worship, but for healing and divination, to locate missing people and important items. He goes on to write that Wasson knew this perfectly well, which is why he employed the ruse he did to gain access to a ceremony. He told Maria Sabina he was worried about his son back home and wanted information about his whereabouts. It has also been suggested that Maria Sabina allowed her photo to be taken on the promise that it be kept private. Her photo was published in the Life magazine article.
Long afterwards, I learned that the mushrooms produce wisdom, that they cure sicknesses, that they have power, and that they are Christ's blood.
The magazine article is available to read online now for free. And when you scroll to the very end, there is a list of acknowledgements. In these acknowledgements, it says that the author is grateful for material aid granted to them by the Geschichter Fund for medical research. The Geschichter Fund had been used by the CIA as a conduit for distributing funds to medical researchers involved in a project codenamed MK Ultra. This was basically a secret multi-million dollar effort which sought to learn how to control the human mind through things such as hypnosis, drugs, and brainwashing. Some reports suggest Maria Sabina was ostracized from her community as a result of the article, and she was jailed.
I have survived attacks from neighbors and relatives against my own person. They burn my house, and they steal from me what little I have.
Or Gordon Wasson wrote in the New York Times in 1970 that he held himself responsible for, and I quote, "unleashing on lovely Huautla a torrent of commercial exploitation of the vilest kind." As for Maria Sabina, she told the visitor, "From the moment the foreigners arrived, the saint children lost their purity. They lost their force. The foreigners spoiled them. From now on, they won't be any good." Now, San Jose del Pacifico. It's in the same state, but quite a distance away from Huautla, and it first came to the attention of outsiders in 1970. This happened because a record-lasting solar eclipse took place, and this part of the world was said to have been the best place on the planet to see it. And so visitors came, visitors saw the eclipse, and visitors took the locally grown mushrooms, and word spread. When I get here, 50 years later, it obviously feels like a tourism industry is growing, but weirdly, it still sort of feels like it's in its infancy. as if word has spread, but it's just spread really slowly. Now, I know what you're asking right now. What on earth does a magic mushroom town high in the Mexican mountains have to do with sport? And you would be right to raise these concerns, because, of course, this is a very serious sports podcast. So, to that end, allow me to introduce a man named Rob Comer, who I meet and get to know in Mexico.
I played for the Mayo minor hurling team. Not a lot of people know that there's hurling in Mayo, but we won two All-Ireland minor C titles. So I have those two medals to... they're in the cabinet at home.
Nice.
I don't know how prestigious they are, but they're something.
I arrive in San Jose del Pacifico, and there's a little cluster of wooden buildings which marks the town centre. Mushrooms are painted on the walls of many buildings. And because of the reputation of the place, you assume that everyone you walk past might be tripping. From the tuk-tuk drivers to the shopkeepers to the small children sitting on the footpath watching you go by. I walk up a hill and out of town to get to my hostel. And as you know by now, this isn't exactly a podcast that outwardly delivers travel tips. I'm going to make one exception here, though, because in San Jose del Pacifico, I stay in a hostel called Bostel Rancho Viejo. And if you ever set foot in this town, you need to stay in this place. And it's a hostel that Rob worked in for a few weeks.
It is, you have to say, the most beautiful hostel
Ridiculous.
That I've ever stayed in. Like, the architecture is incredible. Like, to, it's like no backpacker is used to this level of beauty, like in the design of the place. It's got three bedrooms and six beds in each, and then like the most beautiful kitchen and sitting room and open fireplace and the fire pit in the garden, and the views are just, because it's a mountainous town, so you're just looking over these valleys full of trees, and the clouds come in the evening, and it's honestly some of the most spectacular views you'd ever see, because sometimes you're sitting above the clouds.
Yeah.
So the clouds are below you and then the sun is setting. It's, yeah, incredible.
The reason why I'm bringing a specific hostel into play here is because it's an important character in this story. It essentially becomes the environment for what I can only describe as a pretty weird social experiment. One of the other people checking in at the same time as me, I know pretty well from meeting in Mexico City, but the rest of the people in the hostel, I've never met before. But I say hello, make an introduction, and it is immediately clear that the 8 or 9 guests are all walking to reception to buy mushrooms and take them immediately.
I was like a chaperone for all these people, where they'd come in and they'd all always ask me, like, because that was what a lot of the people came for, is like, oh, do you know about the mushrooms? I'm like, of course I know about the mushroom. You know, it's not a secret. You can get them in any of the stores in the town. Like the butcher will sell you a batch of mushrooms if you've got cash. You know,
how far do mushrooms in Mexican society go back? Well, when Cortes conquered Mexico, his followers reported that the Aztecs were using mushrooms in their religious celebrations. This was naturally seen as a significant threat to the spread of Catholicism from Europe. I mean, wouldn't the body of Christ be a little bit underwhelming when your religious consumption has largely consisted of magic mushrooms your entire life? They're still seen as deeply ritualistic and medicinal plants in this part of the world, and the mushrooms here in San Jose are grown locally. So really there's no problem with the law.
It was like all these different people coming together, and a lot of people only ever stay 2 or 3 days max. So I was just seeing a revolving door of new people, and every night there was just different people like experiencing this psychedelic effect, where it like gives you a different perspective on like your own life and like the nature of what you're seeing. Like, you can just have this newfound appreciation for the nature. A lot of people said that they felt like they were like talking to the trees, and I heard so many stories, so many positive experiences. The only you know, you might get a couple of people that were a bit overwhelmed with it because of that dynamic where you're with a bunch of strangers.
The woman working at the reception in our hostel produces a Tupperware box, and there are several bunches of mushrooms wrapped in leaves inside. She tells us to take whichever one feels right, and away we go. We all sit down at this big glass conservatory enveloped by trees, and we chomp down. We try to get to know each other with hallucinogenics just being ingested. The first person to show the effects of what's just been taken is a woman sitting to my right. Let's call her Patient Zero. Patient Zero starts laughing and seems a little bit troubled by the laughter. Or maybe she's just a little bit embarrassed that she's off the mark first. A woman sitting to my left, meanwhile, is not far behind her, but she goes in the other direction. She's playing ambient music on a small Bluetooth speaker, and she's lying supine in the corner with her eyes closed. The giggles, however, have proceeded to infect a trio on the opposite side of the room. And it would be a string of laughter that, for them, really wouldn't stop for hours and hours. And I learn in this moment that you should probably know who you're tripping with beforehand. Mainly because you never quite know who laughs like a normal person and who does not. One of this trio has the most annoying laugh I have ever heard. It is a laugh that could wake a patient from a coma. And the person who is lying down decides to get up and slide open the conservatory door, close it behind her, and sit down outside, staring up at the sky. Patient Zero has long since stopped laughing and quickly follows suit. One of the cackling trio manages to get onto the Bluetooth speaker and changes the music from the ambient tunes to Kings of Leon. And for me, the final straw has been reached. I also go outside. We sit there in silence, eyes closed, before the sounds from the cackling trio start to bubble up ever so slightly. Oh no, they're all standing at the glass door looking out at us. They crack open the door and stand at the entrance, looking at us, allowing their laughter to infect these beautiful outdoors. Patient Zero opens her eyes and shouts at them, "What are you looking at? We're not fucking zoo animals." This is the sort of experience Maria Sabina would have wanted when she brought a foreigner into these lands for the first time.
I always try to recommend people to take it in the morning, like in the daytime, because that way you can experience nature in all its beauty, because you still have the daylight, which is what it's, I think, is preferred, because then you can actually go outside and be in nature and explore like all the mountains and the like there's so many like wild flowers there. It was like on the hike one time I counted like 20 different like species of different flowers. So that was always my recommendation.
I get up and I go for a walk on my own. There are one or two more familiar faces from Mexico City I meet on my way out, and they're checking in. And there's a comfort in having a brief, normal conversation for a few seconds. But I still feel a strong urge to rip myself away from people. So I make my excuses and walk out into the forest. I sit down on my own and stare at the trees for a certain amount of time. It feels like a good chunk of time, but it probably isn't. I witness the leaves turn colour ever so slightly, and the tree trunks develop human facial features. I wish I could tell you that something more extraordinary is happening in my mind right now, but all I want is to stare at nature, and most importantly, I want not to be joined by any other human being. This whole experience is very internal. I won't lie, it does make me shed a tear or two for no particular reason. And again, I wish I could say this was a beautifully cathartic moment for me. But honestly, I think there's still a chance that I'm just experiencing some trauma of being forced to listen to Kings of Leon.
You know, I might do the hike in the morning and then people will go off doing their things. Some of them will eat their mushrooms. Some of them will make mushroom tea, which I helped a few people make before, and then they'll go off on their journey, and then I might meet them then in the evening, and they'll just look at me with these big eyes like saying, "Oh my god, that was the best day of my life," and I'm just like, "Nice man, nice, I'm happy for you."
Being a big proponent of hostel culture, I have to accept that I sometimes put my enjoyment of a place in the lap of the gods, but if I died by the sword on my first day in San Jose, I guess I get to live by it a little on day two. Because a different dynamic now exists. New faces, fewer annoying laughs. We walk down to the town and we visit a woman called Ruby. And it immediately becomes clear I should have done this yesterday. She asks each of us what we want to get from our mushroom experience what we have experienced with them in the past, and she helps select an appropriate batch for each individual and sells them to us. She tells us that we need to treat the mushrooms with respect, that we need to speak to them before eating them, asking and requesting the experience that we would like. She then sends us back up the mountain to her sister-in-law. Her sister-in-law has a temazcal in her backyard. Temazcal literally means house of heat or sweat lodge, and it is basically just a sauna. There are expensive, bougie temazcal experiences all over Mexico, and this is not one of them. Four of us are shoved into a tiny shed in her small farm, with chickens running around outside. She has coals fired up and heating when we get there, and she shovels the white-hot coals into the corner of the shed, closes the shed behind us with a big plank of wood, and leaves a big bucket of water in there with us. The plank of wood does the job, to be fair, because no light gets in and no heat gets out. We pour the water onto the coals, and it fills the place up with steam that opens every pore in the body. We are also given honey to rub all over our skin, and afterwards, one of our host's grandchildren takes a big bucket of water, and we take turns to essentially surrender to the ice bucket challenge, one by one. This is how one should prepare for taking mushrooms. And I will say, something works better today. This time, the hostel becomes a massive source of amusement, rather than home to a weird, uncomfortable experiment. The texture on the walls, the trippy paintings, such as one of a baby cradling a massive mushroom in space, they all make a lot more sense now. I realise the building is essentially a soft play area for tripping adults. And the sunset that rolls in this evening is genuinely the best sunset I have ever seen in my life. Maybe it is the most beautiful sunset on the planet because of the mushrooms, or maybe it is the most beautiful sunset on the planet independent of the mushrooms. The most beautiful thing, though, is that no one will be able to tell you for sure. We take a journey to get food at night on a tuk-tuk that is adorned with colourful, almost disco-esque lights. My friend sitting beside me thinks we're in a spaceship, and when a dog runs by and starts barking, he fully believes that we are being chased by a tiger. Now, I want to make myself seem intellectually impressive here and tell you that my hugely internal and reflective day was the experience I will truly take with me from San Jose. But really, I would be lying if I said the more visual, more trippy, better crack experience wouldn't be the one I remember most.
To put an extra spin on it, when I got there, I decided I was going to fast for... I like to do extended fasts. Like, I've done a couple of 72-hour fasts before. And this time, I just decided I was going to push the boat out a bit further. So I actually fasted for 106 hours, which is like 5 days. Yeah. And then I ate a few of the mushrooms. But I think I could have eaten a few more, probably because with the dosage, it's like... I wasn't sure, so I ate what I ate, and I basically just went to the viewpoint on my own, and I just looked at the trees in the forest, and they were just dancing, and I put earphones in, I actually listened to Sinead O'Connor's album, and I was just like, just dancing, and all the trees were dancing, it was beautiful, and then I like, obviously, was outrageously hungry, because I had just fasted for so long, so I started eating like fruit, I was eating like just a banana, just, oh my god, it was the nicest banana I've ever eaten. And then I had an avocado with salt, oh my god, it was just sensational. And then it kind of started drizzling, but I was like, oh, who cares, like I'm just there was a hammock there, I just started lying in the hammock, and then I was kind of like scribbling down a few notes of all these wild ambitions of mine, and trying to put a bit of order on my life and what I want and stuff like that.
This has been episode 5 of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball, produced by me, Owen Shahan. If you enjoyed what you heard in this episode, your 5-star ratings would make a big difference, and my handle across social media platforms is Owen Shahan, as all one word, and there is video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast. All of that information is in the podcast description. In the next episode of Diverted, we will travel to Central America, and we will visit the basketball-obsessed highlands of Guatemala. We will take in a Belizean Premier League game, and we will experience firsthand the 2022 World Cup in Costa Rica, where a country went ballistic and dreamed big things for 2 minutes and 58 seconds. Also, part 6 of my Patagonia hitchhiking journey, where I'm finally called into action to actually do some driving. Chat to you then. Thanks for listening.